Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for June 19th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valley and State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Juneteenth Spirit Endures in Valley, written by Jose Gonzalez. Dancers swayed their bodies and stomped their feet on stage at Arizona Heritage Center in Tempe as they illustrated Black American mobilization through the centuries. On June 16, 2024, an audience of about 500 journeyed with dancers as they marched to the cotton fields in the Arizona desert to early 20th century baptisms at Phoenix Canals and 2020's George Floyd protests. Todd Bailey, the Arizona Historical Society's Special Projects Coordinator, hired the six performers for last year's Juneteenth celebration. At this year's gathering, a single dancer was scheduled to perform. The Historical Society operates as both a state agency and a nonprofit, and events like its Juneteenth celebration are often contingent upon federal awards and private scholarships. Bailey said the 2025 downsizing was due to less funding from both sources. Fewer corporate sponsors donated to the event, and the grant application was dropped after the National Endowment for the Humanities announced it was no longer offering funding opportunities for Juneteenth programming. "We needed the grant money this year to compensate what we lost in sponsorships," Bailey said. Juneteenth marks the Union Forces' June 19, 1865 announcement in Galveston, Texas, of the emancipation of more than 250,000 slaves in the former Confederate state. Congress and President Joe Biden made Juneteenth a federal holiday in 2021. Bailey and other Metro Phoenix residents said that Black people had championed Juneteenth for generations, regardless of federal support. "The sentiment has proven more resounding as public and private interests roll back support for diversity, equity, and inclusion." Black people in Phoenix have been celebrating Juneteenth for nearly a century, at least. On May 14, 1927, the entry in the Arizona Republican, the name of the Arizona Republic at the time, mentioned that that year's National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's Juneteenth celebration was scheduled at what is now First Institutional Baptist Church at 5th and Jefferson Streets. "People were doing things long before they were validated externally," said Neil Lester, founding director of Arizona State University's Project Humanities. Some states do not recognize Juneteenth as a state holiday. Among these is Arizona, which recognizes it as a day of observance, having done so since 2016. Lester drew parallels between states that do not recognize Juneteenth as a national holiday, and what he said was Arizona's embarrassing sluggishness in adopting Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Arizona joined the other 49 states in recognizing MLK Day after a 1992 vote. "Even so, people honor the meaning behind Juneteenth, no matter what government entities do or do not do," he said. "I don't know if the holidays necessarily mark some great milestone when it came to people's real practice," Lester said. There's been no shortage of celebrating Juneteenth among Lester's social media circle, where people were teaching dances and discussing planned cookouts. Similarly, Phoenix residents would march miles to honor Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the 1980s, according to previous reporting by the Republic. Still, Bailey said funding through the National Endowment for the Humanities would have helped the Historical Society's Juneteenth program in more ways than just adding dancers, like paid speakers, for instance. Lester and another scholar volunteered to appear. People spend time and effort preparing themselves to present, Bailey said. I really don't like the idea of people coming and working at an event about ending slavery and not being compensated for their efforts. Though the National Endowment for the Humanities grant process fell apart before January 20th, when President Donald Trump took office, there is little to assure Bailey and others that even if they had received federal dollars for Juneteenth events, that those grants would not have had the same fate as the thousands that the agency blocked in early April. The Trump administration has targeted federal grants that support diversity, equity, and inclusion, and has also taken far-reaching actions within the government in the name of cutting those efforts. In collaboration with the administration, NEH has canceled awards that are at variance with agency priorities, including but not limited to those on diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, and environmental justice, as well as awards that may not inspire public confidence in the use of taxpayer funds, read an April 24th statement from the National Endowment for the Humanities. The administration issued a letter threatening to cut federal funding from higher education institutions with diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. The Department of Defense in March removed a web page dedicated to Jackie Robinson. The page on the first black Major League Baseball player highlighted Robinson's U.S. Army service during World War II and was eventually reinstated. The first black woman to head the Library of Congress, Carla Hayden, was fired by Trump in May. White House spokesperson Caroline Leavitt told reporters that the former head did quite concerning things related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, seemingly a reference to Hayden's Of the People initiative to introduce more literary works by people of color into the library's collection. Leavitt also said Hayden placed inappropriate books in the library for children, although the library does not lend books to children. Multiple U.S. companies have scaled back diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts since Trump took office, including Target, Disney, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Coca-Cola, according to Forbes. For Lester, the ASU scholar, there remains uncertainty about how committed many companies are to honoring Juneteenth. They decided to do this after George Floyd's murder. There was a lot of performance of allyship, Lester said, about corporate sponsorships, investments, and statements in the wake of the nation's racial justice reckoning 5 years ago. DEI-related cutbacks have come to Maricopa County governments, too. The Scottsdale City Council eliminated the city's Juneteenth funding in March. Phoenix area resident Ivory Burnett attended the Juneteenth block party on June 14th at Center Point Plaza on Mill Avenue and University Drive in downtown Tempe. The way things are going, it'll be forgotten if we don't stand up and show it, Burnett said about events upholding Black American history amid the current political climate. The Downtown Tempe Authority, which acts independently of the City of Tempe, hosted the event. Along with a DJ, a barber contest, and a breakdancing competition, there was the virtual reality installation, Traveling While Black, aboard a 30-foot city bus repurposed as a mobile theater. Participants used a VR headset to recreate Jim Crow-era segregation. "Diversity makes us stronger as a city," said Tempe Mayor Corey Woods, the first black Tempe City Council member and mayor. State Senator Kiana Sears, Democrat of Mesa, embraced the idea of pressing forward as challenges, including pushback on diversity, equity, and inclusion, arise in honoring Juneteenth. "I think the greatest, if we would say the greatest, flex in the face of adversity is to continue to celebrate, to continue to find those ways to carry on," Sears said. Bailey is carrying on. "There may be only one performer at this year's event, a tiny dancer," Bailey said, "but the child could dance to Diana Ross's recording of Soon As I Get Home from the 1978 film The Wiz. The performance would be contextualized by a presentation on Randolph, Arizona's oldest historically black community, which was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2024. "It's just a modification and a different mindset," Bailey said of the Juneteenth event. "We still have an amazing experience for people." The Arizona Historical Society's Juneteenth event was slated for 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on June 21st at the Arizona Heritage Center in Tempe, located at Papago Park on College Avenue near Curry Road. Bailey was already planning Juneteenth programming for 2026, further underscoring how Arizona has been shaped by black communities across the state. Regardless of the amount of funding, Bailey was confident that interest in paying tribute to Juneteenth would persist. "It feels like there's an effort to erase black history. It's wonderful to see how curious and interested people truly are about communities outside of their own," Bailey said. "That's definitely what has been happening at this event." The next article is entitled, "Colorado River Plan Aim is to Share Pain," written by Brandon Loomis. Negotiators for the seven states arguing over diminished Colorado River water are discussing an option they hope will end their deadlock, one that Arizona officials say would focus less on who gets what and more on what the river can realistically provide. "They're calling it the supply-driven solution," Arizona Water Resources Director Tom Buschetsky said. "And it links the required water deliveries out of Glen Canyon Dam to what actually might be flowing downstream at Lee's Ferry if the dam weren't there. The Rocky Mountain states upstream from there would have to let that amount pass, and the southwestern states would have to live within its limits. It's intended as a fair way of adapting and shrinking the region's use of a river whose flow was once thought to exceed 15 million acre feet of water a year, but in the last 25 years has averaged 12.4 million. Every acre foot contains about 326,000 gallons, or enough to supply a few households for a year. The Colorado State University climate scientist recently projected that the region's warming trajectory could drop the flow to 10 million by the end of this century, a plunge of about a third of the water that the first state negotiators agreed to divvy up with the 1922 Colorado River Compact. "We do have to recognize what the hydrologic risks are to us," Buschetsky said, after previewing the supply-driven concept at a meeting of the Arizona Reconsultation Committee. "And we have to kind of find a way, an equitable way, to share those risks." So far, agreement about what's fair has appeared distant. The lower basin states of Arizona, California, and Nevada have the bulk of the region's population and farm production and have fully developed and then started to cut back on the half of the river's flow that the compact awarded them. The upper basin states of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming have not fully developed their share of the water, a share that no longer fully exists. They have balked at cutting their existing uses to meet the compact's requirement that they send at least half of the river's flow of a century ago, now that a changing climate has exposed the folly of the compact's numbers. The supply-driven model would generally mandate a flow past Lee's Ferry to the southwestern states equal to a rolling 3-year average of the natural flow that the mountain snowmelt provides, Bushetsky said. There would be upper and lower bounds on that number to account for needs such as protecting reservoir levels that are safe for Glen Canyon and Hoover Dam operations. Those bounds are as yet unidentified. While the idea is to spread the pain equitably, it does not mean the water would be divided equally. The lower basin has a much higher river-dependent population and larger established agricultural uses, Bushetsky said, and will naturally need to retain more water than the upper basin can use. It's not a 50-50, Bushetsky told representatives of various Arizona water users at the June 17th committee meeting. I won't try to speculate on what the number might be. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs briefly addressed the committee and assured members that while the state seeks to collaborate, it will also defend its water. Alluding to some 5 million acre-feet of water that Arizona has conserved for Lake Mead over roughly a decade, and a previously proposed lower basin proposal that would take the first 1.5 million acre-feet of future shortages out of those states before the upper basin makes cuts, she said her administration is prepared to challenge any plan that doesn't spread the pain upriver. We've already put real water on the table for our lower basin proposal, and we will make sure that our neighbors in the upper basin do not shirk their responsibilities when it comes to reducing their water use to protect the river, Hobbs said. The Upper Colorado River Commission's executive director, Chuck Cullum, declined to comment on the supply-driven approach. The commission, which includes lead negotiators from the Rocky Mountain states, plans to meet late next week. At a University of Colorado Law School conference earlier this month, Cullum cast doubt on any legal requirements for a fixed supply number in an age of climate change. In response to a question from the Arizona Republic, he reiterated that point this week. If someone asserts a legal theory that there is a fixed supply requirement, he said by email, then the facts of dry hydrology will frustrate them and their theory. While no state has made any commitments to the new supply-driven concept, Bushetsky said, the upper basin and lower basin are exploring it together. They are working with us on the concept, he said. The states, working with 30 tribes and the U.S. Department of the Interior, have struggled to reach a deal to replace dam operating guidelines that expire next year. Until now, those guidelines have used Lake Mead's reservoir levels to impose different tiers of shortage on the lower basin while trying to balance Mead's storage with Powell's upstream. As the river has continued to drain, those guidelines have proven insufficient, leading to the two reservoirs combined storing just a third of their capacity and threatening to cut off hydropower production or even slow river flows past the dams if more dry winters stack up. This year's forecasted flows from the mountains into Lake Powell are not helping. The winter snowpack peaked near average, but the warming climate and thirsty soils and trees have kept much of it from reaching the river. The Colorado Basin River Forecast Center now expects that when runoff season concludes next month, it will have delivered about half of the 30-year average. The Central Arizona Project, which uses Colorado River water to supply part of the needs of the bulk of Arizona residents, has absorbed significant cuts based on the expiring guidelines. General Manager Brenda Berman said that if negotiations don't yield a deal among the states, the Interior Department has wide discretion to impose its own vision as operator of the dams. It's very good that the seven states, the water users, are talking about this supply-driven proposal, Berman said. The idea here is to work toward an amicable way that we have some certainty about what water is coming to the lower basin. And then we will work together in the lower basin and Mexico to figure out how we deal with how much water is coming to us. But similarly, she added, we would expect the upper basin to find ways to work within their own states to meet their obligations. In especially dry years, Bouchatsky said, hewing to the 3-year average could mean that the upper basin states must use less than they currently use, or they could shift water downstream from Flaming Gorge Reservoir or create a storage pool in Lake Powell using any excess they can squeeze out of wet years. In return, Arizona and its lower basin neighbors would likely receive less water than the compact currently guarantees them if the 3-year average drops below the upper basin's old delivery obligation. It really does show that we're trying to avoid litigation, Bouchatsky said. We're trying to come up with innovative ways. A courtroom battle could take years and would take the state's fate out of their own hands. We don't want to be there. Acting Deputy Interior Secretary Scott Cameron attended the committee meeting and told members he's hoping for a deal agreeable to the states by winter. The government must complete an environmental review of dam management options before adopting one next year, and he said it intends to publish a draft by December that explores a wide enough range of ideas that it can cover whatever the states submit by late winter. The government ideally would then promote that plan as the preferred option and make its decision by a year from now. He encouraged all user groups in the state, including on-river farm districts with the best water rights, to think creatively about how to get by with less and how to work with tribes, owners of groundwater rights, or even a desalinization plant now operating near San Diego to meet the state's needs. Having senior water rights does not give you a free pass to ignore what's happening in the greater community, Cameron said. Bouchatsky said his department will soon begin a series of small group listening sessions with interests such as farmers, cities, and tribes to start considering how they may absorb whatever cuts ultimately come to Arizona after an interstate agreement. Those will initially be held in private, but the ideas discussed will surface later in the year when the Arizona Reconsultation Committee schedules more hearings. Those sessions could involve tense discussions with farm interests, such as Yuma's irrigators, who generally have senior rights to the water. A committee member representing those interests spoke up in defense of them. Yuma Farms conserve water for the river and for Lake Mead and is interested in doing more to solve the river crisis, Megan Scott said, but will seek compensation. There's an unwillingness to take uncompensated out-of-priority cuts, she said. That's a fact. After the meeting, Bushatsky acknowledged the challenge, but said agriculture will have to provide part of the solution because it's the state's largest water user. We need them to participate with us, he said. The next article is titled, Trump Hints at Possible Strike on Iran by U.S., written by Dan Morrison. Uncertainty lingered June 18th as President Donald Trump teased a possible U.S. strike on Iran and huddled with his national security team while Iran's supreme leader warned of irreparable damage if Arizona joined Israel's air war. Trump said the morning of June 18th he hadn't yet decided whether to involve the U.S. military. I may do it, I may not do it, he told reporters. Nobody knows what I'm going to do. The president said that Iran wants to negotiate with the United States, an assertion that Tehran immediately knocked down, and suggested his own interest in nuclear negotiations was waning. He said he gave the Iranians the ultimate ultimatum, but declined to say what it was. The president indicated he was still mulling his options hours later, saying, I like to make a final decision 1 second before it's due, because things change. He added that he believes Iran was a few weeks away from being able to produce a nuclear weapon. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei rejected any notion of surrender as Tehran residents fled intensified Israeli airstrikes. We will not accept any kind of submission, he said in a defiant speech June 18th, after the sixth night of airstrikes. He continued, America's intervention in this matter is 100% to their detriment. What they will suffer in this regard is much greater than what Iran may suffer. Trump on June 17th personally threatened Khamenei, calling him an easy target. He also said in a series of social media posts and public comments that Iran should make a nuclear agreement with the United States before it is too late. Though Khamenei said in his speech, life is going on normally, thank God, the military told Iranians to leave parts of the capital for their safety. Traffic was backed up on highways leading out of the city of 10 million people. Arezi, 31 years old, told Reuters by phone that she had made it to the nearby resort town of Levasan. My friend's house in Tehran was attacked, and her brother was injured. They're civilians, she said. Why are we paying the price for the regime's decision to pursue a nuclear program? Israel's military said 50 Israeli jets struck about 20 targets in Tehran overnight into June 18th, including sites producing raw materials, components, and manufacturing systems for missiles. Iranian state media later said Israel targeted an Iranian Red Crescent building in Tehran. In Israel, sirens rang out warning of Iranian retaliatory missile strikes. At Ramat Gan city train station east of Tel Aviv, people were lying on city-supplied mattresses lined along the floor, the odd camping chair and plastic water bottles strewn about. I feel scared, overwhelmed, especially because I live in a densely populated area that Iran seems to be targeting, and our city has very old buildings without shelters and safe places, said Tamar Weiss, clutching her four-month-old daughter. As Israel and Iran trade blows in an escalating aerial war, Israel has its sights trained on taking out Iran's nuclear facilities, and it wants the U.S. military's help. Israel wants the Pentagon to drop the bombs because its own penetrating weapons cannot reach the depth necessary to destroy underground facilities, according to U.S. official who is not authorized to speak publicly. Fully demolishing Iran's nuclear facilities would require 30,000-pound massive ordnance penetrator bombs, or bunker busters, which Israel's military doesn't have. Analysts say it would take a bunker buster to accomplish Israel's goal of striking the Fordo nuclear enrichment facility, considered the toughest target in Iran. Fordo is built into a mountain to withstand airstrikes and has 1,000 centrifuges used to enrich uranium. However, Israel could use smaller penetrating weapons to collapse the entryways to Iran's underground nuclear facilities, Scott Murray, a retired Air Force colonel and intelligence officer, told USA Today. Israel could then effectively bar Iran from recovery work at the sites. Think of it as a no-work zone patrolled from above, he said. Air superiority buys incredible capability and flexibility. The possibility of U.S. military action in Iran is dividing conservatives, a divide highlighted in a contentious exchange when conservative media figure Tucker Carlson grilled Republican Senator Ted Cruz. How many people live in Iran? Carlson asked Cruz in an excerpt released June 17th from Carlson's online show. Cruz, who recently said on Fox News, it's very much in the interest of America to see regime change in Iran, told Carlson he didn't know the country's population. Later, Carlson told Cruz, you don't know anything about Iran. I am not the Tucker Carlson expert on Iran, Cruz responded. You're a senator who's calling for the overthrow of the government in Iran, Carlson retorted. Still, Trump's former chief strategist Steve Bannon, one of the MAGA stars who's come out against the United States actively aiding Israel in attacks, predicted some of the MAGA movement would get on board should Trump decide to join airstrikes. The vast majority of the MAGA movement will go. Look, we trust your judgment. You've walked us through this. We don't like it. In fact, maybe we hate it, but we'll get on board, Bannon told reporters. Trump told Carlson called to apologize for criticizing his administration's approach to Iran. The president said he empathizes with Americans worried about the potential for another long Middle East conflict and Iranian retaliation if the United States were to intervene militarily. I don't want to get involved either, but I've been saying for 20 years, maybe longer, that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon, Trump said. You're listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled Diamondback's Funding Bill to Move Forward in Arizona Senate. Arizona's lawmakers' hustle to pass a state budget in the coming days is expected to bring a key vote on the plan to use taxpayer dollars to fund improvements to Chase Field. The bill, backed by the Diamondbacks, had been stalled for months and was the subject of negotiations behind closed doors. It is likely to be changed again and go before the state Senate for a vote this week. Arizona's Major League Baseball franchise turned to state lawmakers for money this year after they could not reach an agreement with Maricopa County about who should pay for improvements to Chase Field. The team's proposal to divert tax revenues from the stadium to pay for repairs received bipartisan support when it passed the House 35-25 in February. But it saw significant changes after objections from lawmakers and Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, who said the legislature's estimated cost lowballed what could be an over $1 billion commitment. The bill stalled in the Senate, where it did not have enough votes to pass. While the finer details have been debated and changed along the way, broadly, the bill allows the team to use bond funding for repairs and proposes diverting sales and income tax revenue generated at the stadium in downtown Phoenix to pay for improvements. Those tax dollars now fund services like K-12 education and public safety. More significant negotiations led by Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs's office blended various elements from the bill's versions, including adding a cap on the use of taxpayer dollars and reforming the board that oversees Chase Field. The bill will likely need to be amended again to win enough support to pass the Senate and before it goes to Hobbs to consider signing it into law. The bill is expected to move in the Senate as lawmakers vote on the state budget, an end-of-session task that brings last-minute legislative surprises as work winds down at the Capitol. In a June 17th meeting, two Republicans, Senator Jake Hoffman of Queen Creek and Senator David Farnsworth of Mesa, said they opposed the bill. That means the team will need yes votes from Democratic senators who have been skeptical to get the bill to Hobbs's desk. The Senate's Democratic leader, Senator Priya Sundaresan of Tucson, said on June 16th that changes were necessary. "The latest version, with no further changes, we are all in opposition," she said of her fellow Senate Democrats. "We're looking for some kind of more responsible versions or guide rails." Senator Vince Leach, a Saddlebrook Republican who has been involved in the negotiations, said he was confident the bill would have the 16 votes needed to pass the Senate. "We'll have the votes," Leach said. "When it goes up on the board, there will be 16 votes at least." Making changes means the bill would need to be approved again in the House, but that could happen quickly after a Senate vote. Meanwhile, the Diamondbacks have rallied their fans for support. A June 13th email said to season ticket holders from Diamondbacks President, CEO, and general partner Derek Hall includes a website that backs the bill and has information about how to contact state lawmakers. Hall told fans that the vote would take place in days, and with your help, we can make it happen. "Fans have been asking me how they can help, so we provided a pressure-free, voluntary way to contact elected officials," Hall told the Arizona Republic. "It made sense for us to do, since so many have raised their hands to help." The next article is titled, "Senator Mark Kelly Plants Doubts on Golden Dome." U.S. Senator Mark Kelly cast doubt on the physics of a proposed nationwide missile defense system and urged Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to seek a viability analysis from scientists, not contractors. Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, noted that the Pentagon office that could provide such input was largely erased as part of mass layoffs in the federal government and implied those staffers were targeted because they could have raised doubts about President Donald Trump's Golden Dome missile shield as well. This idea, you know, might not be fully baked, he told Hegseth during a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing June 18th. For his part, Hegseth struck a deferential tone to Kelly, who is an engineer, on the scientific challenges inherent in a system intended to intercept perhaps thousands of incoming targets ranging from hypersonic vehicles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and decoys at the same time. But Hegseth maintained the system would be designed using the best technology available today and with an eye toward future challenges. On May 20th, Trump unveiled his plans for a Golden Dome missile defense system modeled after Israel's Iron Dome system, which has helped repel attacks for years, and as recently as the past week during attacks from Iranian missiles. Trump presented his plan as a $175 billion system, though some estimates suggest a comprehensive shield could cost upwards of $1 trillion. Even so, Kelly questioned making an initial $25 billion payment with no basis to expect near-perfect accuracy in intercepting enemy fire. You need something that's at four nines, 99.99% reliability, Kelly said. With all these challenges, and you cut the staff of the people who are going to make sure this thing works before we can make it operational, before we give it to the warfighters. You've got to go back and take a look at this. You could go down the road here and spend hundreds of billions of dollars of the taxpayers' money, get to the end, and we have a system that's not functional. Kelly took a swipe at Trump's questionable relationship with scientific research as he recommended that Hegseth turn to physicists, not big defense contractors, to determine whether the Golden Dome system was workable. Hegseth said that was what the Pentagon was doing. We're leveraging existing technologies and not premising the project on aspirational technologies, what we can actually do, he said. Hegseth did not say the Pentagon was trying to build the system with the four nines Kelly repeatedly invoked. Instead, he said, you seek the highest possible. Kelly called development of a comprehensive defense shield a very hard physics problem. You would know as well as anybody, sir, how difficult solving this problem is, and that's why we put our best people on it, Hegseth said. That prompted Kelly to ask about cutting 74% of the staff for the Office of the Director of Operational Test and Evaluation. Hegseth defended the cuts, saying officials had identified redundancies and unnecessary layers of staff. Kelly asked if the cuts were driven in part by concerns about the office's plan to oversee testing of Golden Dome. Hegseth said the concerns were not specific to Golden Dome. He cited years of delay from that office on earlier projects as reason to dismantle most of its staff. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, Lawmakers Pushing These Bills Through as Session Ends. As budget work at the Arizona Capitol signals the legislative session will end soon, lawmakers are trying to pump life into pet bills. The action centers on bills that have stalled in committee hearings. It's part of the annual ritual of trying to tie up loose ends and score legislative wins before work ends for the year. Lawmakers have no concrete drop-dead date to finish work on bills, but they usually abide by the constitutional June 30th deadline to enact a budget. On June 17th, the House Appropriations Committee passed four bills that have been stalled, or, in one case, a bill that was vetoed but is back for renewed consideration. These sidebar efforts happened as the Senate's proposed $17.6 billion state budget moved smoothly through its first round of hearings, gaining bipartisan support and heading toward an expected vote of the full Senate on June 18th or 19th. Here's what to know about the last-minute efforts to revive bills. Boost to K-12 funding remains in flux. There is widespread support for legislation that would continue a 10-year program that taps money from the state's land trust to bolster the state's K-12 system. But how to fashion an extension of what is known as Proposition 123 has hamstrung efforts to advance a bill this year. On June 17th, the House Appropriations Committee tried to break the logjam by approving two measures that would send the issue to the 2026 ballot for voters to consider. On party line votes, with Republicans in support, the committee approved a strike everything amendment on House Concurrent Resolution 2031, which would direct 6.9% of the earnings of the state's Public Land Endowment Trust Fund to the schools to pay for teacher pay raises. Democrats objected for various reasons, including a complaint that the raises should extend to other school personnel, such as counselors and bus drivers. Several Republicans have reservations about the bill, but voted yes to move the issue along. A companion measure, another strike everything amendment on House Concurrent Resolution 2058, outlines the teacher pay structure. It also passed on party lines. Voters approved Proposition 123 in 2015, but it reaches the end of its 10-year life on June 30th. Freezing Medicaid expansion. The state would halt enrollment in Arizona Health Care Cost Containment System, the state's Medicaid program, for childless adults in the name of fiscal responsibility. The House Appropriations Committee approved a strike everything amendment, Senate Bill 1470, on a party line vote, with Republicans siding with sponsor Representative Justin Olson, Republican of Mesa. Democrats say the bill would be veto bait if it were to get out of the legislature at this late date. Olson says freezing enrollment of childless adults would save $108 million and prepare the state for likely future Medicaid cuts coming from Congress. I think it would be much more prudent to not put people on the program this year than to take them off next year, Olson said in a June 17th hearing. But Representative Nancy Gutierrez, the Democratic assistant leader from Tucson, noted any such move would need voter approval, since Arizona voters approved the expanded enrollment population. The bill follows up on a promise Olson received on June 13th, when he reluctantly voted for the House's $17.3 billion budget after getting a commitment that he could get a hearing on his cost-saving measure. Animal cruelty bill stalled. Animal rights advocates are pushing to get a bill that tightens the definition of animal cruelty over the finish line. Senate Bill 1658 has had a bumpy ride through the legislature, but is now just one final vote from passing the Senate and being sent to Governor Katie Hobbs's desk. Steve Hansen, president and CEO of the Arizona Humane Society, is blaming Senate President Warren Peterson, Republican Gilbert, for refusing to schedule it for a vote before the full Senate. The bill would define animal cruelty as failure to provide adequate shelter for a domestic animal, as well as failure to provide the medical attention that is needed to prevent unreasonable suffering. The bill passed both the House and Senate with strong bipartisan support, but changes on June 11th required the bill to go back to the Senate for a final vote. Peterson did not respond to a request on why he has not yet put the bill up for a vote. Barring land purchases by foreign adversaries. It's back to the beginning when it comes to a proposal to ban China and other U.S. adversaries from buying land in Arizona. The bill, originally introduced by Senator Janae Shamp, Republican of Surprise, had already worked its way through the legislature and was vetoed by Hobbs on June 2nd. But it got new life on June 17th when the House Appropriations Committee passed Senate Bill 1082, an almost identical version to what Shamp originally introduced with an 11-5 vote. Shamp has said the bill would protect military installations in the state from spying and attacks by the nation's foreign adversaries. The bill limits future land purchases and ownership by the nation's foreign adversaries, including China and Iran, and their government officials, political parties, or residents who do not have legal status in the United States. If it becomes law, it would not implement a total ban. The bill allows property ownership for up to 1 year and permits individuals from those foreign nations to buy or own property if certain conditions are met, like if it is residential and at least 50 miles away from military land or critical infrastructure. Hobbs has not yet considered the version of the bill that may be headed her way again, because Shamp's original bill was whittled down to only apply to China before it previously landed on Hobbs's desk. But the bill approved by the committee on June 17th has several provisions that Hobbs had previously called loopholes. Hobbs called the bill she voted weak and spineless, and she made public a harsher version she said better protected the state. But that bill hasn't gotten traction at the Capitol. The next article is entitled, Israeli Attacks Kill 140 Across Gaza in 24 Hours, Medics Say. Israeli gunfire and strikes killed at least 140 people across Gaza in 24 hours, local health officials said, as some Palestinians in the Strip said their plight was being forgotten as attention has shifted to the air war between Israel and Iran. At least 40 of those killed over the past day died as a result of Israeli gunfire and airstrikes on June 18th, Gaza's health ministry said. The deaths included the latest in near-daily killings of Palestinians seeking aid in the 3 weeks since Israel partially lifted a total blockade on the territory. Medics said separate airstrikes on homes in the Maghazi refugee camp, the Zaytun neighborhood, and Gaza City killed at least 21 people, while five others were killed in an airstrike on an encampment in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. 14 more people were killed in Israeli fire at crowds of Palestinians awaiting aid trucks brought in by the United Nations along the Salahuddin Road in central Gaza, medics said. Asked about the Salahuddin Road incident, the Israel Defense Forces said that despite repeated warnings that the area was an active combat zone, individuals approached troops operating in the Nezaret area of the central Gaza Strip in a manner that posed a threat to forces. Troops fired warning shots, it said, adding that it was unaware of injuries. Regarding other strikes, the IDF said it was operating to dismantle Hamas's military capabilities while taking feasible precautions to mitigate civilian harm. On June 17th, Gaza's health ministry said 397 Palestinians, among those trying to get food aid, had been killed and more than 3,000 wounded since aid deliveries restarted in late May. Some in Gaza expressed concern that the latest escalations in the war between Israel and Hamas that began in October 23 would be overlooked due to the new Israel-Iran conflict. People are being slaughtered in Gaza day and night, but attention has shifted to the Iran-Israel war. There's little news about Gaza these days, said Adele, a resident of Gaza City. Whoever doesn't die from Israeli bombs dies from hunger. People risk their lives every day to get food, and they also get killed, and their blood smears the sacks of flour they thought they had won, he told Reuters via a chat app. Israel is now channeling much of the aid into Gaza through a new U.S. and Israeli-backed group, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which uses private U.S. security and logistics firms and operates a handful of distribution sites in areas guarded by Israeli forces. Israel has said it will continue to allow aid into Gaza, home to more than 2 million people, while ensuring it doesn't get to Hamas. Hamas denies seizing aid, saying Israel uses hunger as a weapon. Philippe Lazzarini, head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, called the current system for distributing aid a disgrace and a stain on our collective consciousness, in a post on X on June 18th. The war in Gaza was triggered when Hamas-led militants attacked Israel in October 2023, killing 1,200 and taking about 250 hostages, according to Israeli allies. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.